The LGBTQ Experience in Maine. June is Pride Month, a time when some important landmarks in the history of gay rights took place, both nationwide and in Maine. 50 years ago, police raided the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in New York, leading to days of riots that kicked off a surge in activism and advocacy for LGBTQ rights. In Maine, we're approaching the 35th anniversary of Charlie Howard's death in Bangor, which similarly mobilized Maine's gay rights movement. In 2012, Maine became the first state where voters passed same-sex marriage legislation. I'm Cindy Hahn. Join me for a conversation with LGBTQ leaders to discuss the history of gay rights and where the movement stands today. And we welcome you to share your stories and your questions. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. It has been 50 years this week since the Stonewall riots in New York City, which is considered the galvanizing moment for the modern gay rights movement in this country. Today, we'll talk about where that movement has led us and what life is like now for the LGBTQ community in Maine. Joining me in the studio, Gia Drew. She is Program Director for Equality Maine and one of Maine's first out transgender teachers and one of first transgender coaches in the country. And Howard Solomon. He taught the history of sexuality and gender at Tufts University for more than 3 decades. And he served for several years as scholar in residence in the University of Southern Maine Jean Byers Sampson Center for Diversity in Maine. Thank you both for being here today. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you feel that equality for LGBTQ people has improved? Do you have questions about what it's like to be LGBTQ in Maine? And do you have a personal story to share or a question? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Howard, I'm going to start with you. One of the reasons we're doing the show this week is because of the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots. And there's been a lot of coverage of that in the national news, but it would be helpful if you could just tell us what happened, why is it significant?
Sure. Thank you, Cindy. The Stonewall riots happened on June 27, 1969, at the Stonewall Inn, which was a bar in the West Village in New York City. This bar, like so many other bars in New York, was controlled by the mafia. It was a bar, like so many other bars, where LGBTQ people could gather, and perhaps we'll have a chance to talk later about what those letters mean and whether they really applied in those days. And essentially what happened was on June 27, 1969, there was a bust by the police, an event which happened very frequently that summer and for decades before. And for the first time, the women and men in that bar refused to go passively into the police vans. The first moments of the riot, and some people call it a rebellion, and perhaps we can talk about that as well, were in fact people who were women, people of color, transvestites, and transsexuals. And so part of what is significant about this event as a birthplace is that it represents a different profile of queer activists from the women and men, God bless them, who did the hard work in the 1950s and 60s in their three-piece suits, in their dresses and their nylon stockings, of picketing the White House, picketing Independence Hall in Philadelphia, and essentially saying, we look like you, we are good middle-class white Americans, and we demand our freedom, please. The people at Stonewall were saying, we're not going to take it anymore, and this created a whole new profile of what it meant to come out and demand the equality, which was part of at least the rhetoric of being an American citizen.
And was some of that, did it have to do with what else was happening in the country, in the world during that time, the context?
You bet it did. The context is the Vietnam War, 1969-1970. The context is a movement of civil rights in the country. This is 4 years after, 5 years after the Great March on Washington, led by Martin Luther King Jr., organized, by the way, by a gay man of color, Bayard Rustin.
Hmm.
And so that was part of the background. You bet it was. And it was also, of course, the beginning of what we eventually will call the women's movement. So part of what we want to talk about today is where this is embedded in the whole history of American civil rights.
Of all sorts of minority groups or multiple minority groups.
Yes.
And it's interesting that it's spoken about, it's not somber, this is a celebration.
This is a celebration. We saw that a week and a half ago in Portland, where over 10,000 people during the Pride celebration were there. And the celebration is that we have a proud history to appreciate. We are people who have contributed and continue to contribute to American culture. And this is a moment, like all great anniversaries, to take stock of where we've been and to look forward positively.
And there was another occasion for that. We'll stick with some recent history, or relatively recent history, with Gia. Maybe you can talk about the other important landmark in Maine. It was a similarly galvanizing event of Charlie Howard's death in Bangor. Can you tell us about that and where that led us?
Sure. You know, about 15 years later, in 1984, a young man, Charlie Howard, probably in his about 20 years old, he and his friend were walking down the street on a warm July night in Bangor when he and his friend were approached by a group of teenagers in a car. And those teenagers were calling Charlie and his friend homophobic slurs, things like that, out their window. And unfortunately, things got worse as the night went on and the kids jumped out of the car and started calling Charlie and his friend more names, and name-calling turned to pushing and shoving. And they got to a bridge in downtown Bangor, and they were threatening to push Charlie off the bridge. And Charlie, you know, screamed out, "I can't swim." And eventually Charlie was pushed off that bridge, falling, you know, 30, 40 feet to the Kandusky stream below, and was killed, you know, for the sheer fact that he was a gay man.
And the reactions to that at the time?
Very mixed, definitely very mixed across the country, in the state of Maine. But in Bangor specifically, you know, this was a galvanizing moment for the LGBT community here in Maine, where people said, you know, this is not who we are as a state. This is not who we are as a town. What can we do to ensure this never happens again here in Maine? And so a group of concerned citizens and up-and-coming LGBTQ activists, you know, formed a small group, which became the Maine Lesbian Gay Political Alliance, which is now Equality Maine.
Your organization.
Exactly.
So what are the kind of key moments of progress? That did that just move things forward, or were there a lot of obstacles to progress in gay rights here in Maine?
Well, that was really the one of the first visible signs of coalescing in a public way around LGBTQ rights. You know, up until that point, and how we can add to this, it was a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering and work and things like that. But, you know, the visibility piece was so important, you know, whether you're going to hold a vigil in public for Charlie, and how do we organize, and how do we elect officials, and how do we pass laws, and how do we talk about our community in a positive way and attack and those stereotypes, and how do we build community? How do we make sure that people who are part of the LGBT community across this large rural state feel like they're connected and not alone? And so that really was a galvanizing moment in 1984.
When you mentioned not being alone, were there allies, other groups that sympathized or helped with the cause?
There were. There were several different, actually, faith-based groups that stood out, you know, at risk to themselves for being an ally to the LGBTQ community. And I think that's some part of the conversation that gets lost in the movement, is how important many faith-based organizations have played a role in supporting the LGBTQ movement.
Howard.
And part of that movement, one of those moments, was in 1975 when the state legislature in Maine passed a Human Rights Protection Act, which protected all people in the state of Maine, irrespective of their race, their age, their physical abilities, and their ethnic status, from discrimination in housing, credit, public accommodations, et cetera, et cetera. In 1975, Lois Reckitt, resident of the state of Maine and one of the founding vice presidents of the National Organization of Women, approached Jerry Talbot, the first African-American legislator, elected a state legislator from the state of Maine, to introduce into the bill an amendment to that, to adding sexual identity and gender expression to that. Jerry said, I don't know any gay, lesbian people, but if this is about human rights, I'm with you. And it was Jerry Talbot, it was Gerald Conley Sr., and other allies. And we did that organizing within the state legislature year after year after year from 1977, when that amendment was introduced, all the way up through the 1990s. And the significance of Charlie Howard's death was, as Gia said, it galvanized the community. And where we had numerous allies and a handful of really courageous, hardworking LGBT people doing the hard work, Charlie's death brought this now out into the public. And it ramped things up dramatically.
We actually got a Facebook comment about this from Maureen. She says, my wonderful friend Lois Reed, who was president of the Unitarian Church in Bangor, led the memorial for Charlie Howard each year. The Unitarian Church was very caring to the LGBTQ community. Lois died recently. Yes. Her obituary can be viewed online. This community cannot forget such a courageous woman who cared about others. Were you familiar with her?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes. And among the religious groups in Maine, mm-hmm. the Unitarian Universalist community deserves a particular tip of the hat here.
So not to turn to the negative, but obviously this wasn't so easy. What were some of the objections to after Charlie Howard died that, you know, were kind of going against what the LGBT community was moving forward towards?
Part of it had to do, and this was happening nationally as well, from 1975 on, indeed even before that, for example, in 1973-74, when the Wild Stein organization was founded at University of Maine, Orono, and was the first public LGBT organization in the state of Maine, we were accused of demanding special rights. The special rights that they want, as opposed to our argument that we want the rights that all American citizens have. And so from the very beginning, number one, the conversation in the state of Maine was based on this whole false principle of you people want special rights, number one. And number two, because of the outspoken and in many ways temporarily successful activities of fundamentalist religious groups in the state of Maine, that conversation of civil rights from the beginning was instead couched within the whole issue of sin mm-hmm. and special rights. And so much of what we worked for two decades against, and indeed we can push it all the way up till through 2007, 2008, was trying to work against this misleading and fear-based rhetoric about special rights and that we were fundamentally sinners, and so the whole issue of civil rights was not something to even be talked about.
So that's an area where there has been progress, as you said, coming up till today, and we'll talk more about that after the break, but I wanted to take a moment to go through some of the terminology because I've been saying LGBTQ. The older way, I guess, was just to leave out the Q, and there's some with many more initials and acronyms. So can you just kind of tell me how this terminology has evolved, what terms are preferred today, and maybe define some of the less familiar terms?
Yeah, sure. I think that's a very common question, and it is constantly evolving the way we use the language around sexual identities and gender identities. And so when we say LGBTQ, and, you know, these days actually we're adding a plus at the end because there are just mm-hmm. so many letters. So, you know, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, And then plus could be that there are so many other sexual minorities and gender minorities out there that we want to be inclusive. So there is no, you know, one way to sort of say everybody is included. I think one word that I think we want to make clear with folks is the word queer.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, it's been a very negative word in our community and used against us in very hurtful ways. But in recent years, it's been reclaimed by many people in the community. And so you'll hear people say, I'm part of the queer community, or that I'm queer. And so I think that's an important word to understand when we're talking about LGBTQ.
And when you say that it has been reclaimed, it now has a positive connotation and it is the more inclusive term, I think people who are not in the community using it feel uncomfortable saying it, but that's okay.
Well, I think it's a very delicate term. I think if you're going to be using it and you're not in that community, I think you should be able to at least do a little homework around what it really means and what it really feels like to be part of that community.
Mm-hmm.
And also within the community. We're talking about a community of multi-generations,
right,
et cetera, et cetera.
Humans.
For people like me, who's about to celebrate his 77th birthday on Stonewall Day tomorrow.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Happy birthday.
Thank you. The word queer has been a hard one to wrap my head around, and I'm comfortable with it today. I was not 5 or 10 or 15 years ago. And then one final point, when I started teaching what today might be called history of sexuality or queer history in 1969-70, the course was called social deviance.
Oh.
That was the category that sociologists and historians used to talk about quote-unquote, sexual minorities. So we have come a long way.
Times do change. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Penobscot Financial Advisors, self-proclaimed geeks committed to the financial fitness of Mainers. Learn more at penobscotadvisors.com. And Veryl Dana, proud sponsor of Music That Moves Me on Maine Public Radio, airing throughout the month of June. Learn more at mainpublic.org.
10 candidates will take the stage for the first Democratic presidential debate. Expect them to cover topics from healthcare to income inequality.
I am not for free four-year college for all.
The best way to get there is by having Medicare for all.
I have some concerns with the Green New Deal.
Universal child care for every baby 0 to 5.
I'm Ari Shapiro. How the candidates compare to one another this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. The Maine Public News Tell Me More tour will be in Waterville this Thursday as Maine Public News travels the state to hear directly from you and learn what you feel are the most important issues in your community and how Maine Public News can best serve you and keep you informed. We'll be in Waterville tomorrow evening starting at 5 p.m. at the Railroad Square Cinema at 17 Railroad Square. Our discussion will be led by News Director Mark Simpson with news reporter Robbie Feinberg and Andrew Catalina, Maine Public's Manager of Digital News. For more information about all the Tell Me More tour visits, please visit mainpublic.org and click on Events or the banner ad.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, LGBTQ rights from the past to the present. Joining me, Howard Solomon, activist and former scholar in residence at USM, and he taught queer history at Tufts. Gia Drew is program director for Equality Maine, a former teacher and coach and transgender activist. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We were just talking about sort of sensitivity of preferred terms and all of that. And we have a tweet from Equality Maine saying, something as simple as adding pronouns to your email signature can make a huge difference towards LGBTQ plus acceptance, especially if you're cisgender. Does your job include pronouns in your email signatures? So let's talk about this because that's new to many of us who that never was a thing before and now you see it. It's a little bit confusing to me because when, for example, if you say she, her, hers in your email signature, why do you need all three of those? Is one enough?
Yeah, one could be enough, but I think it's just to clarify that this is who I am and these are the pronouns I would like you to use when you're talking about me or referring about me. And so whether it's me and I use the pronouns she, her, and hers, or someone else who uses they, them, theirs, or he, him, and his, It's a practice that we encourage many folks to do in their businesses and their workplaces, to when we're having group conversations, to introduce yourself and share your pronouns. We just don't want people to make assumptions about people's identities just based on a name or an appearance or things like that.
Okay, that makes sense. And also not to feel like we're only accommodating certain people, that everybody's on the same page.
Exactly. You don't want to just be like singling people out. You just want to make sure you're being affirmative in that way.
Okay, great. So we were talking more about the history. Let's move forward in time to Maine in 2012 when the voters supported the gay marriage referendum, and that was a first nationally. So tell me about your involvement with that effort, how it felt when the referendum passed, and just even actually haven't shared that much about your own personal journey.
So that's a really historic moment for the history of the United States and the history of Maine in 2012. It's actually the first campaign I was involved in at Equality Maine. I had been a teacher and coach for 20 years up until that spring. And while I transitioned on the job a year before and had been coaching for a while, things didn't all go well. And my job was eliminated 6 months earlier and became unemployed and unemployable, unfortunately, as an out transgender person in the state of Maine. Despite wonderful laws and policies that protect LGBTQ people, you know, if people don't want you, people are going to find a way to make you unwelcome. And so I found an amazing community here in Portland, Maine, that I was able to connect with, Equality Maine and Maine Transgender Network and GLSEN, where I started volunteering and getting more involved. And in the 2012 Campaign for Marriage, I became part of that campaign. And it really was a great place for me to feel safe and welcome compared to other places I had been most of my life. And so here in Maine, later that fall, Maine became the first state in the country to pass marriage equality by popular vote. And so that really was historic for the state of Maine and for the country.
You mentioned your story, so I want to back up a little bit because we didn't hear the kind of beginning part of that and the lead up to you coming out as transgender. Can you share some of it?
I can, sure. You know, when I was I've known since I was a little kid. I was born in Boston in 1967. And by the time I walked to elementary school in 1972, I knew I was a lot more like my two sisters than my four older brothers. And so it's been in my heart that I'm a girl and I'm a woman. But it was a very hard place to say that out loud in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And it wasn't until nearly 10 years ago that I was able to say that out loud publicly. And in doing so, I transitioned on the job here in Maine, becoming one of Maine's first out transgender teachers.
And you said it wasn't easy as far as work goes, but what about personally with the family members or friends?
Yeah, that's, you know, I think everyone who walks their path has a different situation, and I really had no idea how people were going to respond. I was hopeful, you know, you were going to do something really big and challenging, and I was just very hopeful people would be on board, and for the most part, people were. I think that's the thing that I really unfortunately surprised me the most. You know, my family was really lovely and still are. School was more complicated. There wasn't a rule book or a playbook for how schools should operate and how should they support a transgender teacher and coach. So I think people were more confused at that time. Colleagues, administration, parents of students and athletes. I think it was just a lot of confusion on how do we support a transgender teacher. And this is only 8 years ago. I will say that the students that I was working with were the most miraculous. They were the most accepting and welcoming of having a trans teacher, you know. I told them, you know, you can call me Miss Drew now instead of Mr. Drew. And they were like, okay, what's our homework?
It's easy with kids.
Yeah, they had other priorities in their life, you know, compared to, you know, being a trans person in the classroom.
Right. Okay. Well, Howard, now we want to hear about you. As your 77th birthday approaches, things haven't always been easy for you, I assume.
No, yes and no, in the sense that, I think the first thing I would say is that the coming out process, whether it was mine or Gia's, or anyone who's listening today, is an extraordinarily liberating and personal and spiritual moment. And so I think the first thing is to recognize that we all do it in our own way, and we honor that. For me, coming up as a teenager in the early 1950s, I remember sneaking into the junior high school library and going up to the dictionary and looking up the word homosexuality. And it said to me that I was pathologic. It said to me that I was a sinner, et cetera, et cetera. There were no models at that point. On TV, well, hardly TV was brand new then. There were no models. I knew no gay people. And so for me, the whole process of coming out was very specific to my moment on the planet, so to say.
At what point was that?
Well, it's interesting. For me, June 27, 1969.
Well, you're really linked to this date.
Well, I'll tell you more. Here's another link. I was teaching. I was finished my first year of teaching as a newly minted PhD. I was at New York University in Greenwich Village. About 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, I'm having a drink with a friend of mine on a bar on 8th Street, and I started hearing police cars, which even more than a typical Friday night in New York City in the summer. And didn't think much about it. And the next morning, reading in the New York Times on about page 8 or 9, a little article about this riot at the Stonewall Inn. I was extremely closeted at that time, struggling to understand who I was. And one of the things that Stonewall did for me was to convince me I don't want to be like those street people, transvestites, troublemakers, et cetera, et cetera. And there were a lot of other reasons why I left New York City and moved to Boston. But a part of it was a homosexual panic. And so to fast forward, it wasn't until about 1975, 76 that I came out. And one of the ways in which I came out as an historian was through the histories and understanding better and better what my culture was about. And also then meeting, and then one final point, since we're sitting in a radio studio. Elaine Noble, who was the first lesbian elected to state legislature anywhere in the United States, had a radio show on WBUR in Boston when it was just a dinky little college station. On Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 in the morning, and she and a gay man talked about their lives. And for me, it was the 1 hour a week where I was safe. I could listen to them. And I had the privilege about 10 years ago being in a room with Elaine Noble and thanking her. And so as it turned out, I finally, to make a longer story short, was teaching at Tufts University, wonderful university, loved almost all of it, and in 1982-83, a course that I had first called Social Deviance in European History, and then Marginality and Power, and then Sexuality and Gender, we started calling it Lesbian and Gay History.
So that evolution. Well, the idea of coming out that you talked about has evolved as well, because like you said, it was very much discouraged. People were conditioned to be ashamed, and all kinds of negative repercussions with your job could happen. But what about now? There's almost an opposite attitude. There's a pressure for people to come out, even if they may not feel ready. What do you think of that?
I turn to Gia, who... because you're working with young people much more than I am these days.
No, I understand where you're coming from. I think there is a pressure to come out and celebrate who you are. But there's also the flip side. Why should I? Other people don't have to come out. Why do I have to come out? You know, why should I go through this extra step or hurdle to prove something to somebody for whatever reason? I think there is that attitude as well. But I think one of the things that we're noticing, and Howard and I were talking before the show, is just when we were kids and teenagers, no idea that you could be out as a teenager, for example. And what we know now is so many young people are finding the space and the visibility to say this is who I am at a very early and earlier ages. And so that's really exciting to meet and interact with so many young people across the state of Maine who are thinking they're part of the community or saying they're part of the community. And that's amazing to know that they're probably around 15% of teenagers in the state of Maine who identify as part of the LGBTQ community or questioning their sexual orientation or gender identity. And so that's really exciting for people to say that. And we're trying at Equality Maine is to make sure that the spaces where they say that, that they feel safe and welcome and celebrated for who they are. So that's one of our big challenges in the work we're doing today.
Okay, great. Well, joining me on the line now is Sunny Dean. She's a Maine-based author and illustrator who has a new children's book out, and it's about the Stonewall Riots. Thank you for joining us, Sunny.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm a huge fan of the show.
Oh, great. Well, the Stonewall Riots don't automatically come to mind as a subject for a book for children. Tell us about it and why you wrote it.
Quite true. It's basically a book that I would have liked to have read as a child. And I know the subject matter was a little touchy. You had to kind of strip the story down to its most basic elements, but came up with a story that basically is about a little yellow square that is in a world full of blue triangles and pink circles. And she's struggling to fit in and not accepted for who she is. So she runs away to a wonderful place called Stonewall, and she finds every shape and color imaginable and people who understand that being different is good.
Huh. So do you feel that today's kids do have are they more receptive to learning about differences, or they have more chances to be aware like this?
I think they are and they aren't. I think in some ways things are definitely harder now, but in some ways easier as well. I grew up in the 1970s, and you know, when I was growing up, I lived in a rural area, and we didn't have a single person who was out in high school. And when I was in seventh grade, I think it was, our school history book had one sentence about Stonewall, and I read it every single day thinking, this means I exist. So I think there's a lot now that is better, but there's still an awfully long way to go. I mean, right now in more than half the United States, you can still be fired from your job or you can lose your housing just for who you are.
Well, thank you for sharing all that with us. Sonny Dean is an author and illustrator in Maine with a new book out about the Stonewall riots, or inspired by them. Thank you, Sonny. And we actually have a related call about books. So Allie, calling from Maine, somewhere in Maine. Allie, hi, where are you calling from?
Hi, Cumberland, Maine.
Okay, Cumberland, great. And can you tell us what you wanted to talk about?
Sure, yeah. So my wife, first of all, thank you, Cindy, for hosting the show. And thanks so much to Howard and Gia for all you both do in Maine and nationally, day in and day out for our families. So my wife and I have a six-month-old and a six-year-old who have two moms. And it's great to follow Sunny's call because I'm also calling about children's books. It's hard to find children's books that feature our two-mom family type among so many other underrepresented kids and families and kids' books today. So we founded an effort called Our Shelves, which is a diverse children's book subscription service with a dual mission to address two problems in the children's book industry that it sounds like Sunny is working on as well, and that both Howard and Gia kind of alluded to in different ways about kids not feeling alone and, you know, being introduced to many different kinds of children. So the first problem that Our Shelves is trying to address is that many of the high-quality LGBTQ and other diverse children's books that do exist can be really hard to find for a variety of reasons. And so the first part of our mission addresses this problem. At Our Shelves, we've assembled an expert curation team that finds the best of LGBTQ and other diverse kids' books available. And then we deliver these books to our members' doors through a quarterly subscription service. So that's kind of the first piece. And then the second problem that we're here to address is, as all of us know, there aren't enough LGBTQ and diverse children's books, period. And yet, there's a significant market demand for these books that goes untapped. So, for example, take the 12 million inclusively minded millennial moms out there, and those are just the millennial moms. And so the second part of our mission is to advocate for the many diverse books still needed by proving, organizing, and leveraging this significant market demand. So if you have listeners who are interested in making sure, you know, in getting support and encouraging their bookshelves to really reflect LGBTQ and other diverse families and to cultivate their inclusive values, come to ourshelves.com. And also if you want to be part of standing up for the market demand for these books, so the publishers really feel there's opportunity in this space, definitely check us out at ourshelves.com.
All right. Thanks so much for sharing that, Allie. Thanks for calling in. And we do need to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the law offices of Joe Bornstein, Maine lawyers committed to working for Maine people since 1974. Learn more at joebornstein.com. Invisible Fence of Southern Maine, who understand the importance of keeping pets happy, healthy, and safe at home. InvisibleFence.com. And Evergreen Home Performance, a Marvin replacement contractor offering window and door replacement services. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
I'm Tobin Lowe.
And I'm Kathy Tu. We host the podcast Nancy, all about the LGBTQ experience.
We hope you'll join us for our radio special filled with stories about a different kind of coming out.
You'll hear from gay men talking about what it's like to disclose their HIV status, a woman who tracks down her long-lost queer role model, and a son trying to save his father's life, even if it means a painful confrontation.
So tune in and celebrate Pride with us.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
In Maine, childcare isn't always easy to find. It can cost as much as a state college tuition and forces parents to make tough choices affecting their families, careers, and finances.
I don't think moving to Maine was the best move for my family. I don't. It's been really, really hard.
All this week, Maine Public Deep Dive focuses on childcare, on air and online at mainepublic.org/childcare.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, LGBTQ rights. Joining me, Gia Drew, Program Director for Equality Maine, and Howard Solomon, educator and activist. Join our conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. And earlier we talked about that there has been progress. Gia, you were saying for young people today, things have certainly gotten better and easier, but that doesn't mean serious problems don't still exist with hate crimes, bullying, discrimination. So can we talk about what are still some of the challenges facing the LGBT community?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, we've made great progress here in the state of Maine specifically on policies and laws. And even just this last legislative session, we were able to pass 4 or 5 really significant laws that would protect LGBTQ people. And one of them is to ban the practice of conversion therapy against minors, which is a really historic thing to do. You know, and I think one of the callers mentioned that there are still 30 states across the country that don't have significant protections for LGBTQ people. But you can pass all the policies and laws that you want, but until you really change hearts and minds, people are still going to be discriminated against, still going to feel bias, and hate language is still going to exist. And so, unfortunately, we're still learning and dealing with young people and older folks who are dealing with discrimination on a regular basis. And unfortunately, there was a significant uptick after the lead up to 2016 and after the 2016 election in the amount of hate language, hate crimes across the country and here in the state of Maine. And so marginalized communities are getting the brunt of that. There's been a rise of anti-Semitism, definitely a rise in hate against the LGBT community and against new Americans and immigrants who are here in Maine as well. And so I think we're very mindful that while we can celebrate these victories across the country and here in Maine on LGBTQ rights, there's still a lot of work to do in terms of changing hearts and minds, especially in some of the more remote and rural spaces here in Maine.
Why those areas? Why is it more difficult?
Well,
there?
I think there are limited resources in those areas. There's less drop-in support groups, less places to go, and maybe people are a little less, maybe more afraid to come out in those spaces. You know, we talked about coming out earlier, and one of the most astonishing facts that still persists to this day is people who are part of the LGBT community are still not out at work. 46% of people of the LGBT community are not out at work nationwide. So there's still a lot of discrimination and bias and stigma against LGBTQ people. And so in those little spaces, and it doesn't have to be rural, but just spaces where there isn't such an inclusive, welcome climate, it still can be very hard to be LGBTQ.
And you think when they're not out at work, it's out of their own fears, or is it valid that something would happen to their job or to their position?
It's a matter of many different things. It's their own fears, or maybe they've heard other people say discouraging things about LGBTQ people like that. And so many folks don't come out because they don't want to risk having to face backlash against being LGBTQ.
I'd like to approach it from a slightly different point of view. And that is, when we talk about these challenges facing the LGBTQ community, these are challenges facing our entire culture. And it may be that our community is in many ways the canary in the mine shaft that reflects and experiences the most horrible parts of those. For example, and again, I'm turning to my colleague Gia for the numbers here, when we talk about homeless youth,
yes,
an overwhelming proportion of those are LGBTQ young people.
Because?
because they're kicked out of their houses, because they don't know where they have a safe place to be. It's tough enough being a teenager, let alone dealing with those issues. In terms of the people at the other end of the age spectrum, for seniors, I'm part of an organization called SAGE, which is a national organization. Again, we do things in our own way in Maine. While there are chapters of SAGE in the big cities all across the country, we were the first statewide chapter of SAGE, which is an organization advocating for LGBTQ seniors. And part of what we're seeing, for example, as we deal with the challenges facing seniors in this community, there are people in the 50s, 60s, and 70s who are struggling to come out. And many people who are out who now find themselves perhaps having to go into a nursing home, that nursing home may not be the safest place for them. So while there are LGBTQ-specific issues, these are in many ways issues embedded throughout our entire culture.
Okay, interesting. Let's go to Brian. He's calling from Augusta. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about a new resource designed especially to help LGBTIQA youth feel more part of their communities and less isolated. As a chapter leader for the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, I was disheartened that we had no really good resources for use with gay-straight alliances in our junior high schools and high schools. So I spent the last 10 years developing one. It's called Rainbow Quest. And it's something that the New Jersey Education Association is very excited about because they now legislate the inclusion of LGBTQ history and culture in their school curricula. So we're doing a Kickstarter now, and I've had many people with libraries, gay-straight alliances, teachers, and community groups who are real excited about having a new resource developed especially to help cultivate and affirm our LGBTQ community.
Well, thanks, Brian. Is there? I don't know if you're able to post something on our Maine Calling Facebook page. That would be helpful.
I sure can. That would be great because we're doing our Kickstarter now. We're trying to get it done so that we can have this in schools by September.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling. And we will go to another call now from Bobby calling from Portland. Hi, Bobby.
Hi there. I wanted to say something about Stonewall history that you left out of the program. A big part of the initial Stonewall riots was included bisexual people, and they generally are not mentioned. And then it's really important to know who Brenda Howard was. Brenda Howard was there at Stonewall, and she had the idea of organizing the first Pride March. And so she initiated Pride marches in the United States, and she led the effort to have one in New York City.
And how do you know all this, Bobby? Were you in some way involved?
I was not personally involved, but I know some of the people who were there.
Okay. Is your own story somehow connected to all of this?
Yeah, in some ways.
Okay. Didn't know if you wanted to share any of that with our audience.
Not at the moment. I'd like to say something, too, about people coming out. There's a lot of conversation about people who are young coming out. I think living in a state that has the oldest population, we need to be paying attention to people who come out late in life. I know that Howard just said something about that as I was picking up the phone. And I'm very pleased to know that SAGE is here because SAGE originally was just in New York City, and it was absolutely bi and transphobic for a long time. So it's nice to know that we can all be on the same page again.
Well, thank you for calling, Bobby Howard. Did you want to comment
on that?
Thank
you. Thank you, Bobby. It's so great to hear your voice. Thank you.
Okay. So when we're talking again about some of the struggles that are currently being faced, are organizations like Equality Maine focusing your efforts on particular policy or public awareness?
Absolutely. I think one of those callers, we're talking about what we can do to help young people, and Howard mentioned the prevalence of homeless youth who are LGBTQ. And so, you know, we can only do so much in terms of where we have access. And we definitely have access to schools, especially with schools who want to do a better job to support LGBTQ youth. And unfortunately, though, we've been, pardon the pun, stonewalled for the last, you know, 8 years on trying to work effectively with the Department of Education specifically. You know, we still lack comprehensive guidelines for schools on how they should support LGBTQ students. While we've had a law that protects LGBT youth for nearly 15 years, we haven't had any guidelines that have come from the state level to the schools. And so right now there's a patchwork across the state of schools and school districts that have some have policy, but many don't, on how to support LGBTQ youth and what the law actually says. So we're really encouraged by the new administration to work with them to come up with some policies and guidelines, so every school and every school district really understands why it's important to support LGBTQ youths, so we can prevent some of those things like homelessness.
Mm-hmm. Howard.
And one of the things that we know with the dozens of schools in the state of Maine that have a Gay-Straight Alliance and the couple hundred or so that have human rights teams, and this is true nationally, where there are groups like this supporting LGBTQ youth, the number of suicide and suicide attempts across the board go down. So to put it simply, what's good for LGBTQ youth is good for everybody.
Okay. We have a Facebook comment from Gary. I am 56 years old and came out on my 53rd birthday in October of 2015. It was very liberating and a huge weight lifted off my shoulders. I did what was expected of me in the 80s, being raised in Lewiston, son of a prominent city figure. They say that being gay is a choice, but in my case, I chose to try to be heterosexual. I married and had a child, but there was always the truth weighing down on me. I had never acted on my feelings until after I came out. I have a partner now and am extremely happy. The only regret that I have is that I wasted my wife's life. You hear stories like this often?
All the time.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think there's so much pressure for us not to be ourselves, that we make these choices and make these deals with ourselves and the people we interact with, thinking it's the best thing for everybody involved. And I have a similar circumstance. You know, I hid my trans identity from most of the world until 8 or 9 years ago. And I had been in a marriage for 17, 18 years. And so that was really hard to sort of reconcile what that looked like for each of us. Fortunately, we're in actually a better place, both of us, and we're still good friends. So Sometimes things work out for the better, too.
So we just have a few seconds, but how hopeful are you for progress?
Oh, I'm extremely hopeful, you know. I'm only 52, and I'm looking forward to the next 50 years of progress where we don't need Equality Maine anymore. And I think that would be a great initiative, is to put myself out of business.
I'm extremely optimistic. What I have seen in the last 5 years, let alone the last 55 years, is just incredible.
Well, thank you both for joining us today. Howard Solomon taught the history of sexuality and gender at Tufts University for more than 30 years, and he was a scholar in residence at USM Center for Diversity in Maine. Gia Drew is program director for Equality Maine and one of Maine's first out transgender teachers and also one of the country's first transgender coaches. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling's executive producer is Jonathan Smith. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.